Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.
The question is that there are some differences partly between the infrared image and the visible image. And I think the answer that I have is that there's considerable difference in the quality of the cameras that were used to take these. In one case, in the visible, we have very high quality photographic film and cameras. In the case of the infrared imagery, it doesn't come even close to matching the resolution. So that's one difference. The other differences have to do, I think, with the film that was used to take the scope picture of the camera. I mean, that's, you know, and I frankly don't know anything about the linearity of that film. So that's a question. And by the way, that's an issue for everybody to consider when they're looking at images, and make sure that they understand what they're looking at. Make sure they understand the so-called gamma of that film, if it's linear or very nonlinear. It's very nonlinear, you get artifact that really isn't there. So I don't understand the film to take the picture that we show. And I also don't understand very well the optical characteristics of the camera that we used at the time. So these could both very easily account for the discrepancies that you are talking about. I don't see any reason to postulate that there's any fundamental difference because of the strong correlation of the visible image and the infrared image. They're correlated, in my view, very closely. There are differences. You can see that in the infrared case, they're distorted and so forth. But there's a strong correlation between the two. Frankly, it's a correlation that I didn't expect, but was jumped out at us. And so we're very pleased to have that result. I would not attribute any of those differences to anything fundamental. I hope that answers your question. Oh, yes, another question.
Okay.
Okay, from a general point of view, there is a strong correlation. But if we go into the details, there are differences that I think are quite interesting. For example, the lack of an image in the correspondence of A is not found in the visible image. In this case, if we suppose that the image was caused by radiation, can we suppose that the radiation acted more in an area than another? So in the infrared, we are able to detect where the radiation acted more and or less.
I don't think I would really offer any comment on that whatsoever. In terms of speculating about what processes caused the image in the first place and whether there is an attributable difference in the infrared image versus the visible image to some effect, I would speculate on. I would offer that up as a research project, however, to someone who wants to look into the differences between the infrared image and the visible images, and see if there's really a structural difference there.
I have a question. I have a question for Joe.
Everybody
does. My question is this. In your, albeit limited, ability to get these infrared images, were you able to detect any differences from between the infrared and the visible light images in the banding areas on either side of the face, which absolutely there is an effect of the banding on the image formation mechanism, because the dark bands that are on either side of the shroud's face have caused a lot of skeptics to say, well, the man, it can't be real because the guy's face is too narrow. But all you need to do is a very simple little lightening of that banded area, and you'll see the rest of the cheek, the hairline, yep, and the cheek line, which is absolutely on the shroud. But we never get to see it on these high contrast images because it always goes below the threshold.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I'm curious whether you were able to see image in those banding areas or whether you were not able to detect it or whether it wasn't something you were able to see.
I think the answer is no. I didn't look. That's probably the simplest answer.
There was, and I don't remember which one it was. Maybe one of you guys can tell me. There was one special test that we took that did reveal the fullness of the you remember which one that was?
No. Might have been Vern's infrared.
It might have been Vern's infrared, because I remember it was very exciting to see the flow of the cheek.
Might have been the UV photos.
What he was talking about, when he says UV, he's talking about the shortwave infrared, the very low, right above the visible region of the spectrum, not the long wave, so it's a difference in. I would not really comment. I expect from first principles that I would expect a correlation simply because of the relationship between the reflectance and the emissivity. There would be a strong correlation between the two images, period. Now, any differences that are noted between those two images, I would attribute to artifacts in the camera. To first order, I would attribute to artifacts in the camera and other than. You know, there is an issue in the infrared that I didn't want to talk about, is that slight variations in the cloth, you know, that the cloth was not necessarily stretched tight. Those little variations in angle, you know, the observation angle, will cause a difference in infrared received radiation. And that in itself could be the cause of the differences between the two. So right offhand, I'm not going to assign any phenomenological difference based on process to the differences between the two. I expect them to be correlated. They are largely correlated. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I offer it up as a research project to anybody who wants to look into it.
Joe, in your paper, you mentioned that you had illuminated or excited with 1,500-watt lamps that you bought from, or you borrowed from Barry.
Which, actually, I borrowed from a local Italian photographer.
My question, first of all, is did you front-light it, back-light it? How did you light it, front-light it? Okay. And the second question is, did those have the thermal infrared or near-infrared protection on the lamps where it doesn't project the heat forward? As far as you know, it did not. No?
Did not.
Okay, so they were not just like a projector lamp.
Standard, no, they were standard quartz halogens.
Very good, thank you.
One other question that I have.
There was a videotape
of the infrared, and I know because no one was available to hold the camera, so I held the camera, and what became of those? It was a video.
Are you talking about the same infrared that I'm talking about?
I assume. I don't know.
You and I are going to have to discuss this.
Thank you.
Sure.
I've got a two-part question. It's not a scientific question at all. But I like each of your... each a short answer on both parts of the question from each if possible. And maybe it's a question basically that I used to be a federal prosecutor, and I asked this question of my investigators. This investigation's been going on for a good long while. We've had a lot of very intelligent people looking at it. So the question is basically, how far down the knowledge trail have we really come? Specifically, if 100% represents everything that's significant and knowable with today's science, do we know 95% in your opinion, or do we know 75% or 50%? And if the percentage is fairly low in your mind, what specifically critical information is missing? What next do we need to do?
Ooh. That's a tough one.
You want a short answer to that.
Yeah.
What time does this place close? As far as the knowledge trail is concerned, my impression is it looks like we have just a huge amount of information. I brought the 1980 National Geographic down for some other questions that were being asked. But when I consider things that need to be retested, when I consider the lack of full spectrometry with modern instrumentation, when I consider the things that relate to X-ray like imagery, please understand I didn't say this was an X-ray. I said the X-ray like qualities within the image, which there are numerous ones, and the study of those relative to actual human anatomy. And then ultimately we need a spatial database so that we can correlate all this information, like a geographic information system. And what that means is if you go down to your local county assessor's office, they have access to a device called a geographic information system. And every spot on Earth has multiple layers of information in this database. So I can take a spot on the floor, and it belongs to so-and-so. It's in such and such a state, such and such a county, such and such a country. It's mounted over such and such a kind of turf, soils. There's wires buried under here. There's maybe gas that goes into the building. All of the things that talk about that one tiny spot on the face of this planet, they have information on. I bring it up on a computer, and it's a layered database. We need to do that with the Shroud of Turin, because otherwise you can't correlate all this information, all these things that Alan's coming up with, all these things that spectrometry shows, all the things that blood analysis shows, all the things from the different spectral signatures, all the things from the different years of photos, all of that needs to be correlated. And that requires a spatial database, like a geographic information system. So what that was a short answer, by the way.
Google Shroud.
What percentage down the road have we gone?
You answer the question.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what?
Probably 80% there, or 90% there, or what are we?
I'm going to give us about 0.1%. There's things that are going to surprise the heck out of us as we keep going.
Fair. Opposite the short answer.
Of all the things we could know, given unrestricted, of all the things we could know, given unrestricted access to the cloth, I mean, totally unrestricted, we could cut swatches out of it for you. I'm being a little facetious. But frankly, that's, you know, in my view, that maybe the only way we're ever going to get down to the nitty gritty. I think maybe we know about half of what we could know at this point.
Gee, thanks for quantifying that for me, Joe. You're far more qualified than I am. But I like what Pete was saying, and I guess we could call it Google Shroud.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can do that now online and look at virtually every square inch of the planet.
Right.
So I think it's a great idea. But as far as Larry's question goes, I think that it's rather arbitrary to try and put a number on it, Larry. Sorry, but I would go with the 50% because that's sort of right in the middle, and that sounds like a reasonable place.
Good it's a political year. It's a nice waffle number.
It is. But, you know, diplomacy is very important in the world of the Shroud. So I'll just pass it to Ken.
My question would be to answer your question with a question. What is the purpose of quantifying it? In other words, what are you trying to get to by putting a number on it? Because if what you're trying to do is say, what is your decision about it, then we might be further down the road than if you're trying to say what is the end result we can expect, if you follow what I'm saying. And by that I mean this. I long ago passed my threshold to believe that this is the real burial cloth. Okay? Period. Done. Long time ago. Do I think we know everything? No. If you read my abstract, I said I don't believe faith will ever allow us to find the so-called smoking gun, if you will, of symptomology. I don't think it's going to happen. But depending on unlimited access, as Joe just said, or what other testing we may do, hey, maybe we're 75% down the road. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. It's really hard to quantify.
I'm going to back up your question to 1978. When we left Turin, we knew thousands of times more about the Shroud than had ever been known before. 2 years later, when we met in Connecticut and saw what everybody had done with their data, we found out what we didn't know. We didn't know a whole lot more than we thought we didn't know. And so I won't quantify things, but I think my point being that further investigations, I'm getting closer to that goal of knowing everything. You're going to open doors and say, oh, wait a minute, I thought I was 90%. I'm back to 30% because I got this whole new field.
Different way to ask questions, briefly.
Just like a lawyer.
By the way, you didn't see me. You can't prove anything.
In a criminal case, you have to know beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
That does not mean certainty. Okay? In a civil case, you have to make it more likely than not. Okay. So each of you, again, if you're going to be my witness, well, that's a question. Since, you know,
Which side would you rather be on, maybe? In a civil case, if the burden of proof is more likely than not, is it authentic is the first question, more likely than not. If we're in a criminal case, and the issue is not certainty, but beyond a very reasonable doubt, you know, are you going to be, which side are you going to be on then? Is it the state of knowledge sufficient to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? Or is it just beyond, just more likely than not? Or is it less likely than not in your individual judgment?
That's an easier question to answer,
yes.
That's an easier question?
Well, it is for me.
Me too. Good, go.
You got it. Oh, you go. He's messing with me now.
In a criminal case, if your witness, or the defendant, let's say, just suddenly stands up and says, I did it, well, that's, you know, I confess. Well, that's the nail in the coffin. That doesn't necessarily imply that you know everything that there is to know about the whole situation, but that one thing puts you over the threshold, as radiocarbon dating could have put us over the threshold in that account. In other words, I'll go back to what I said earlier, maybe we know 50% of everything we could know, but that one little fact of elemental radiocarbon dating would have kind of sealed. Now we could, in terms of belief, yes or no, is it real or is it not? I mean, if we had a valid radiocarbon date, I think that would have answered that question, or at least it would help to answer the question. Now there's still a lot of questions left about how it was formed and so forth, but if it's a 13th century object, then most of us would say, well, clearly it's not authentic, and maybe a bunch of other people would go on to continue to do the research and try to figure out what it is. It is a singular object, there's no question about it. But there's a difference between how much you can know and what the threshold of belief is, I guess is my point. And there are certain little elements that come up here that could come up, like radiocarbon dating, that would push everybody over the threshold very easily. Yet not represent all of what we could possibly know.
Thank you, Jim. Well, okay, the threshold of belief, I guess that's kind of where I'm going to go with this, because, first of all, I'm not a scientist like some of these guys are, okay? I was an absolute, total skeptic and expected to get to Turin and see the paint and the brush strokes and go home, and frankly, at age 32, I was thinking, wow, a free trip to Italy. That was about the extent of the depth that I had about the Shroud of Turin. And it only took 17 years of studying the data and fortunately being close enough to the data itself that I had access to it. But it took 17 years for me to reach the threshold. And, you know, I'm Jewish, so I didn't come into this kind of with any underlying emotion other than free trip to Italy. But I'm now convinced, based on my access to the data, including the radiocarbon dating, which was a big shock because I knew about the Prey manuscript, which indicates the Shroud existed at least 70 years earlier, that I have come to the conclusion that this is more than likely to be what it's purported to be. Now, I'm going to share a quick anecdote about my 85-year-old little Jewish mother born in Poland, emigrated through Ellis Island. She finally heard when Ken was there, we were back in Pittsburgh 4 years ago, I gave a Shroud talk, we all did, and driving home, I asked my mother, what do you think? And she was very quiet. And then she turned to me and she said, well, of course it's authentic. Well, I'm shocked. This is a little 85-year-old Polish lady who, you know, went graduated from high school, not well-educated. And so I was baffled. And I asked her, well, why do you say that? And she looked at me in typical Jewish mother fashion and she said, Barry, they wouldn't have kept it for 2,000 years if it hadn't belonged to Jesus. I know there's a certain Jewish mother wisdom there that's pretty amazing. And so now I tell that story particularly to the Protestant, non-Catholic audiences I talk to because they seem to need to have a certain kind of external reinforcement to this. But to answer your question, I reached that threshold, frankly, when Al Adler explained to me personally why the blood was still red. That was the last thing that kept me from accepting that this could be the authentic artifact. And when Adler explained that, you know, the 30-some hours of torture, the breakdown of the red blood cells, the flooding of bilirubin into the bloodstream would keep the blood from ever turning dark, black, or brown, That was sort of the last thing, because when Vern Miller and I stood side by side and the shroud was first laid in front of us, we looked at each other, we looked at the blood and went, that ain't real. So it took 17 years to get the answer to that, and that was sort of the last piece of the puzzle for me. So as far as threshold of acceptance, I reached that 13, 14 years ago.
I think it's pretty obvious where I stand if it's threshold of belief. How I reached it is maybe a little different than some of the other guys on the team, because I had to make myself step back from what I felt and believed in order to write the proceedings, in order to edit the reports, in order to meet on Good Morning America or whatever. I had to step back and say, okay, this is what we have to say because this is what we know. Having said that, you know, we used to have this little quip, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, it's a duck. Let's take it a little further. If it looks, swims, flies, has pin feathers like a duck, quacks like a duck, its mother was a duck, we're going to say it's a duck, but maybe we haven't found duck DNA yet.
I'm going to approach it a little differently. I'm going to look at different levels of the word authentic. My first question is, do I believe it's authentic in terms of it's really a 2,000-year-old cloth and not a forgery of later time? And I'll say my personal belief on that is probably 98-99%. Next question of authenticity, is it authentic in the sense that what's on the shroud is the image of a man who was crucified and tortured? My belief in that is 98-99%. You look at that shroud closely, up front and personal, there is no question in your mind, nobody made this thing. And you don't judge that looking at photographs, you see the cloth in front of you. Okay, now you get to the last question, is that man Jesus Christ? Sorry, Ken, but ever the scientist, scientists prove things by disproving negative hypotheses, typically. They walk their way up the ladder and take a lot of wrong routes along the way. But
when they get to the top, I'll be that way.
And so, I asked myself this question, and I've used this reasoning in a lot of shroud talks, and that is that as a scientist, watching more and more pieces fall into place, like Barry was talking about, my personal estimation of the probability that the man in the shroud is Christ had crept up into the 92-93% range. Then the carbon-14 came out, and I said, boy, you know, a lot of people are saying it went down to 0%. I said, no, you know, everything's not in yet, you know, so I'm going to say, in my mind, I fell back to 80, low 80%. All right. Then when the carbon-14 got the issues with it were made public, I'm right back up there in the 92-93% range. And the reason is I can always think of a scenario, and there are a lot of reasons why it doesn't quite fit, but 2 or 3 years later, the Roman guards are crucifying another guy, and one of them says, hey, let me tell you what we did to this guy in Jerusalem a couple of years ago. Let's do that again. That was fun. And you can't discount that possibility. So again, purely from not letting my spiritual side of me get into it, which is very plentiful, purely from my scientific side of my mind, that's the way I do it.
Pete's going to go. Give Pete's a shot.
Go. Okay.
Go, Pete.
I guess I'm not used to hearing legal questions. Certainly, I think I said what I said in my talk. I'm putting my life on the line for it. Not just because of the Shroud of Turin, but the Shroud of Turin reads like a gospel.
Yes.
And if you don't see the gospel in those images, you're not paying attention. So I'd have to say, yeah, it's a slam dunk for me. I know which side I'm on. I'm going there. On the other hand, if I'm just going to investigate and I'm looking for the truth, and I've got two people that both want to know the truth, and one of them is kind of leaning one way and the other one's kind of leaning the other way, which one has the deepest pockets? I'll work for him. Because I want to find the truth too. I didn't go into this with bias. I went into this totally ignorant of what it was. Totally ignorant of what Shroud was. And I haven't found anything to contradict that yet, save for the one anomaly of garden dating.
That's it.
attempts that are made to duplicate the shroud.
Two minutes.
Just comment off the top. 423.
Oh, that's a joke.
I would venture to guess that at least in the last 20 years, I've probably seen all of them, however many that might be. For some reason, maybe the website or a higher profile that I've taken in the last 10 or 15 years, a lot of people send me their stuff. Look what we've created. And the funny part of it is that nobody even gets close. And I mean, I've had people like Emily Craig, a forensic anthropologist, came out with a paper a number of years ago. And, you know, I read it and I just went, my God, this is just totally impossible. But I started catching a lot of flack from people out there saying, oh, you don't have Emily Craig's material on your website. You're obviously afraid that she's got an answer and you don't want to admit it. And I probably got about 30 emails like that from around the world. So I called up Emily Craig and I said, Emily, I need to publish your paper. And she got permission from the journal, and I reprinted the paper, and I have not received one email regarding Emily Craig's theory once people got a chance to see it, read it, and look at the results. Because it would have created a result that was so unlike the shroud that it's to be totally incredible. The other thing is she made no attempt to account for the bloodstains on there, which, at least from the forensic experts, tell us that these are natural, legitimate blood flows, not painted there by some artist in the tomb in 2 hours. And I did point out to Emily, but she didn't seem to get it, that Jewish burial custom is such that on Friday night when the sun goes down and it's the Sabbath, that's it, no more work. So what artist would go into a tomb after the beginning of the Sabbath to paint an image of a guy who's dead there that wouldn't be violating the law to a point where they might be the next person on a cross?
And it's the high holy day Sabbath, so, you know, the rabbis will really get it.
Yeah, so the answer to the question is countless numbers of attempts have been made. I've probably, like I said, in the last 20 years seen most of them, maybe because I'm a photographer, they send them to me, and nothing has even come close. Not even close.
It was a Christian artist.
There were no Christians. There were no Christians.
One of the things that when Barry was talking to you came to mind, and that is that all of the imitations, reproductions, however maybe we might want to call them, concentrate, seems like, on the 3D aspect of the imaging. I mean, it's like, let's forget everything else that's there, and I mean, there's a huge amount of other stuff that's there. Okay, and the 3D aspect, I'm going to tell you right here, right now, it's not perfect 3D, folks.
Yeah.
Because there's blood stains on top of the shroud and not imaged in 100% of the area. Yeah. So when you see some of the distortions, when you look at the 3D aspect of the shroud, it's not perfect. And so part of the acid test in looking at somebody's attempt to make a shroud is to see if the distortions are equal. To see if the anomalies are equal, and they're not. And they never are. Not in any of the ones that I've done.
One more point, in all fairness to Emily Craig. Emily Craig spent 25 years as a medical illustrator before she became a forensic anthropologist. So her knowledge and skills of human anatomy are far superior to the average person. Emily Craig also studied the shroud quite extensively before she wrote her paper. And one of the things she figured out was how to create a similar effect of density at the higher points, darker image at the higher points that would have been in direct contact. She integrated that into her result, which moved her closer to a reasonably kind of accurate portrayal of what we see on the shroud. But all the other chemistry and physics were wrong. So you got it. Like I say, making images on linen, easy. Making images with the same chemical and physical properties, good luck.
And if you really want an answer to, is it possible to create one of these things called the shroud? I don't think you can do better than Isabel Pisek, who's a little tiny lady who is a masterful artist in her own right,
and absolutely destroys with her paper any possibility that you can do this with a human hand, then goes on to write a paper on the physics of the shroud.
It's about 1:26. I think we'll end it there. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for that. That was very enlightening.
Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.